Accession number 29540, Mr. Norman Cole, Reel 7. Now, where did you go next? After, you've gone back, but you next seemed to go to Tilburg.
Yeah,
Tell me about that.
Went through Breda into Tilburg, and there we took over a school, which was not being used, of course, and set up our unit there, the 9th Survey Regiment, took over the whole school. And just north of Tilburg was the River Maas, and the Germans had been driven back across the River Maas. It became the front line for a long time, for a long period. We on the south bank, Germans on the north bank. And because we were there a long time, several things happened. One of the things that happened was that we were warned that the Hermann Göring parachute regiment had landed in the area of the German army just across the river from where we were, across the River Maas. So it was anticipated that they would be dropping their parachutists onto us, so that's why they were there. So we had to keep our vehicle engines warm so they could be driven away at speed, at quick notice. We had to carry our arms everywhere we went. We didn't cross the parade ground without carrying a rifle with you. So, in case they came over, well, later that day, I took a patrol out because I wasn't too happy about what was going on behind the school. So I took a patrol out and went around the back of the school, all rifles and bayonets at the ready, and slowly came around each corner to see if there was any signs of the Germans, but of course they didn't, in fact, land. They didn't come over.
But it was constant precautions against it.
That's right.
Now, what about, you seem to have got on with, I'm not sure whether you're in Holland, or I never know where the boundary of the Netherlands and Belgium is. I don't think a lot of people know.
No, it is in Holland all the time.
You're in Holland now, right?
Yeah.
How did you go with the locals there? You seem to have been quite friendly with some.
Oh, extremely. There was a young girl came up. She must have been about 16, something like that, and started talking and invited me back to her home. And when there was an opportunity, I went back to this girl's home and got to know the family. That family became almost like one of my own. We were there. There was this girl was Audrey, who I became very friendly with. I think I've said in my memoirs, in different circumstances, I think I'd have married her. But she had an older sister, older brother, two younger brothers. And I used to go there quite regularly when I was not on duty. I left to go up to the Maas on duty and take my turn. I'd probably do 48 hours up there and come home for 24 hours, something like that. And whilst we're there, did all sorts of arranging sports and that with local people as far as we could. But one evening I went to this house, like I say, but come like my own family, and they were absolutely devastated. They were sobbing away. And what had happened, not the youngest boy, but the second younger boy had gone for an errand from his mother to a shop just a couple hundred yards away. And the Germans had dropped bombs. The Canadian Armoured Division had been hiding in the streets, and the Germans had obviously seen them and dropped bombs. The mother ran out, picked up her son, and he actually died in her arms. And when I went back to the house, of course, they were absolutely devastated there. And this boy, before he went out for the errand for his mother, had done a drawing of Jesus Christ wearing the crown of thorns. And he said, if Norman comes, let him see this before I get home. He'd left this drawing for me to see. He so much wanted me to see it. But he went out and was killed. And I actually went to the funeral. I got permission to come, because I was due up at the Maas, actually. I had permission to come back and go to the funeral. Went to the funeral service. There was seven other people, I think, who was killed at the same time. and they made it a civic funeral. There was one long procession. Leo, the little boy, was the youngest, so they put him in first. We were in the first column going towards the cemetery. Only the men went from the church to the cemetery, and we walked in single file, and then they were buried there. And choir came up from the church, sang hymns on the spot, and I remember as I got to the coffin, I did what a soldier should do. I stood and saluted, and then moved on. We walked back in pairs to the house, and the ladies had gone straight from the church back to the house and had coffee waiting for us when we got back there. But I was given a couple of printed cards concerning Leo's death, and one a card dealing with all the deaths, a civic card in effect, and I've got that in my memoirs.
And we'll get a copy of that for the Department of Documents, as we said. Now, funny enough, I'll let it go, but this sporting business, there's some stuff about hockey here that seems...
Well,
it's a lighter mood, I know, than what it's been. But, I mean, well, tell me about that, the hockey games.
Well, I'm one of the few people who can say I played hockey for England, because the local hockey club made contact with us and asked if we could put up a team to play them and give them some practice. So we obviously agreed. It was a great bit of fun for us. I'd never played hockey in my life. They had to explain the rules to me before we could play. But we went out and played this game against them. And afterwards, I saw in the local paper, it was reported that their local team had played England. So I can say I played hockey for England.
And another slightly amusing story is this story of your runs in the post truck. You seem to have had an excellent run of luck in the post truck.
Yeah.
Tell us that story.
Well, I'm not sure I could remember it all.
What was the post truck? What were you doing?
Well, collected the post for the regiment and coming back in a 1500 weight truck. And just everything went wrong. It stopped. We had water coming out of the radiator. The fan belt broke. I couldn't remember all the things that went wrong with it. But in the end, we got a tow. And blow me if a tow bar didn't break. We just stayed quiet for a while, and after we were able to get a fan belt from somewhere that fitted, and in the end we just slowly drove back, got the engine going again and slowly drove back. But it was just a trial after trial of trying to get that vehicle back to our unit.
Anything else about your time? You seem to have been there till February, so almost, September, October to February?
Yeah, long time.
Were you there when Arnhem was on, or...?
Yeah,
you haven't mentioned Arnhem, but that's earlier.
Well...
You weren't really involved in Arnhem, were
you? Yes. That separate note I've written is about Arnhem, because it's not in the notes at the moment. I'm not quite sure where it goes in, but... what happened, where we were called away from Tilburg... to go into the relief of the paratroops at Arnhem.
So that would be mid-October, mid-September.
I think it was the 21st September or something, wasn't it? Anyway, yes, we were called up to try and help to try and get through. We got towards Nijmegen, and the tanks were coming along as well, of course, trying to get up, to break through into the encircled paratroopers. And we were told to pull off the road. It was quite a narrow road, and the tanks just had to get through. So we pulled off the road and let the tanks go through. And eventually, of course, we were there and quite a while, and everything started to come back, and we had to come back because they couldn't break through. And that was the story of Arnhem. The relief of Arnhem just didn't succeed. So we were pulled back again. It was a failed operation.
Now, you stayed there at Tilburg then till March, from the looks of it. Anything else you remember about that?
Only one thing. The day we were told we were going to move, I inexplicably I got a motorbike, which I hated.
Now, tell me about that. Why did you hate your motorbike?
Well, from the time I first... I had to learn to ride a motorbike for my professional proficiency badge in the Army. The Surveyor's Proficiency Badge, first class, you had to be able to ride a motorbike and drive all sorts of vehicles and that. And the very first time I was given the motorbike, I broke it. I let it go and it snapped. I think I've told that story.
You did,
yeah. Yeah. So I hated motorbikes from then on. I just never did like them. And whilst we were at Tilburg, I thought I'd go out and try and arrange a football game for our people. You know, we enjoy playing football. So I took a motorbike instead of a Jeep. Why? I have my clue. And it was whilst I was out trying to make that arrangement that the order came through that we were to leave Tilburg and make for Germany. So the football match never took place. But why I rode that motorbike, I've got no clue. I hated them.
So your next move, you seem to go to North Beveland next. That's in southwest Holland.
Yeah, it's an island. It's Valkeren Islands. And we were
that's one of the Valkeren ones, isn't
it? Yeah, North and South Beveland. We were sent up there. For what purpose, I really don't know, because the Germans had gone. We were only there a couple of days.
So this is in February, is it, or March?
Well, I believe you, whichever you say. Yeah, March, I think.
And anything, what was the situation at North Beveland?
Well, it was just quiet, just very much a country area, but farming area. We were billeted to a family. And the thing very noticeable about the Beveland Islands, they all wear national costume day by day. The ladies wearing these white butterfly hats. Men wearing their dark blue baggy trousers. Even little kiddies wearing traditional costume day by day. Not especially for Sundays, this was their daily dress. And it was quite colourful, being there.
You got on well with this batch of Dutch as well?
Got on well with them person to person, but understanding them, no. We got to a point where we could speak a little bit of Dutch and understand a little bit of Dutch. But they got a dialect which is completely different. We were able to make no contact with them verbally. And they didn't seem to understand any English there either. So it was all done by sign language.
Now, there's a story about cooking a meal. It seems a fairly ridiculous story. Do you remember that?
Yeah. There was a bath parade. People could parade and go to a bath, which was unusual. And the two people the two cooks we had, who normally cooked our meals whenever we were stationary, decided to go for a bath. Well, we had a meal to get, because they were going to be away quite a while. And two of us were volunteered to do the meal. And we had meat, we had vegetables. The one thing we didn't have was potatoes. And me, being a Devonian, they all assumed I could make dumplings. So we decided we'd make dumplings. We got all the ingredients together, flour and fat and salt and so on, some milk. And we kneaded this together, made it into balls, and dropped it into boiling water. And after quite a while, we looked at them, thinking they'd all gone mushy. No, they weren't. They were still there, neat balls, and we were so pleased. And then it came time to dish up the meal. And we brought the vegetables out and brought out these dumplings. Well, I always said they played hockey with them afterwards. You couldn't get them through them with a knife. They were so hard. So I never tried cooking again.
Now, what were we actually doing there? There's some talk about the Mars again and an island position. And
yeah, so we were up on the front line again, still doing our duties up there this time. And,
at North Beveland, or Beveland?
No.
So
back to Tilburg.
Yeah,
we went up to Beveland and then back to Tilburg.
Right. Right. Okay. Well, I've got you now. So you came back to Tilburg.
Yeah.
Now, what happened there? That makes much more sense to me now.
Right. Right.
No, so what happened there?
Came back to Tilburg. Well, what happened was there was snow on the ground. There'd been snow showers. And not only were the Germans on the other bank, there was an island in the middle of this river, which was occupied by the Germans. And for some reason or other, our forces resented this very much, and they were determined to drive them off. And whilst we were up there, these troops arrived, all in white clothes, white helmets, white bandages on their rifles to make them, everything that could possibly be white was white. And they went along to opposite the point of this island. And there was a bit of a battle went on. And eventually we learned that they came back and the Germans were still there. And we were told afterwards it was a crack SS troop that was actually on the island, and they fought their way in defence and succeeded.
Now, another story is you had to go and collect a half-track. No, it was a half track.
I didn't know it was a half track.
Now, tell me the story. I've rather given away the end there. But
well, I was told I had to go and collect a 15 underweight truck. So I took two drivers, one to drive the truck that was going to take us there, and the other driver to bring back the truck we were collecting. So we had the two drivers and myself. When I got to this depot, Sergeant Major was the one that met me and got me to take over this 15 underweight truck, and I signed for it. And I remember him saying, right, now let's go and get yours. I said, there isn't one for me. Oh, yes, there is, he said. I said, are you sure? He said, yes. So he took me along, and there was this M14 half-track vehicle. I'd never been inside one or anything like it. So he got in it. He said, this is a beauty. I tuned it myself. Listen. And he started it. If he hadn't started it, I'd have never known how to start it. Because the starter was actually the clutch pedal. You press the clutch pedal and that was the starter. But once the engine fired, then it became a normal clutch pedal. So, but for him getting in to show me how good it was, I wouldn't have known how to start the thing, leave alone drive it. And driving it, we had a long way to go. I think I said at times about 70 miles, but it was a long way. And the thing was, without knowing it, when you're driving a car, you change gears very much by sound, the sound of the engine. But the sound of these tracks, about you couldn't hear your engine at all. All you could do was change gear by timing it and guesstimating. And we stopped. I remember we stopped and had a drink somewhere on the way back. And I was so pleased to be given a bit of a break from this because I found it a bit trying. But eventually we got back all right. So I collected the vehicle that I'd never driven before.
Now, you stay there. when they go across the Rhine in March 1945, you don't go with them, do you? You stay back in Tilburg. Because you seem to be there in May at the end of the war.
Yeah, when we went up to the Rhine, just after it had been crossed in one point, because there was all the German equipment, all their horse-drawn guns and everything, including, I always remember, one huge sort of, it was like a huge bowl, and in it was soup. And I remember saying at the time, the soup was still warm. The Germans hadn't been gone all that long. They'd fled across the river, left all their equipment there.
That sounds earlier rather than because on March they were crossing the Rhine. You'd remember crossing the Rhine.
I don't know when we crossed. Actually, this was up to the Rhine, but we didn't cross then.
Right. now, what about there's a liberation celebration parade in Tilburg? What do you remember about that?
Yeah, I knew that was a big do because this was. this was organised by the city itself. Princess Juliana was coming to take part in this, and I was off duty, so I went into the centre of Tilburg, and there was crowds and crowds of people there. After a while, there was a parade of singing choir boys and scouts and so on coming along, and they went into the main square. And there they stopped in front of the town hall, and there was singing and dancing and so on. And there was a great big illuminated traffic sign there, at the right opposite town hall. Me being in a fit and active soldier, I got on top of this traffic sign, and I had a panoramic view of everything that was going on. And eventually, Princess Juliana came onto the balcony, and there was the national anthem was sung right away, and there was more singing and dancing, and that was the end of the celebrations as far as I was concerned. I just watched it and came away.
Now, we've had a look at the things, and there's some problems with the dates, because you say you've only moved out of Tilburg on the 22nd of May, and there's some reference to advancing and having the Germans on the run, but the war was over in Europe then, so yeah, that's a confusion. But now, you've got a story that's really rather good about crossing the border, advancing into Germany and crossing the border, that illustrates very well how you felt. Could you tell us
that? Yeah. I remember seeing the sign on the side of the road to say we were entering into Germany. And in a field at the side of the road, there was a great area actually being tilled by an elderly couple working there, probably an old man and wife. And I remember shouting out to them, words I'm ashamed of now, I shouted out to them, "Work, you bastards, work. That's not me."
Now, why did you feel it? How did you feel about Germans? Talk to me.
Well,
a bit
I think
about
we
that.
Got to the point where we hated Germany and everybody to do with it, because we knew about the concentration camps and things like that at the time. So anybody connected with it, we despised them and hated them. But it didn't last. Once we were in Germany, we just came to the point where we ignored them.
Now, tell me about your first impressions of Germany, because it's a very different country as well. And you quite liked it, didn't you?
Very different. Well, I mean, Holland, the people are nice, but the country's pretty flat and uninteresting. But as you moved into Germany, you were moving into a very attractive countryside, rather like my own county of Devon. There were hills, woodlands, fields. It was quite an attractive town and area. And the people there, I found, were better dressed than I anticipated. Whether they, again, like us, we were putting on our best to not sort of degrade ourselves, whether they were dressing themselves to their best so they looked that they weren't, defeated in effect.
What about the bombing damage? Because that must have been pretty evident to you.
Well, yes, in particular in the towns, of course. In the countryside, you don't notice it so much, but the Antwerp, Hanover itself was absolutely devastated. I was convinced that Hanover was finished. I remember saying at the time, I can't imagine that Hanover will ever be rebuilt. I thought they'd start a new city somewhere else. It was so devastated.
Was there anything left standing?
Very little, but I came across one I thought was a building standing. I was most surprised there's one building, but as we got nearer to it, although it was a few stories high, it turned out to be just a front wall standing. The whole of the floors and walls behind it had collapsed. So it wasn't a building after all. It was just literally a front wall standing.
Now, what about how you got on with the civilians and this question? Yeah, I understand you hated them when you first got them, but how did your relationship develop them, and what influence did the non-fraternisation policy have on them?
Yeah, well, that was in strict order, of course, non-fraternisation. We weren't allowed to talk to them. And very quickly, we got to a point where we just ignored them. I don't think we despised them or hated them or anything else. They just died away.
The hatred went.
The hatred went, and we just sort of ignored them.
Did they try and contact or talk to you or make contact?
No, not normally. Not normally. I don't think they had the confidence to at all. I think it was deep down there was still someone frightened of us. They didn't know what we were going to do. We were an unknown quantity to them.
What about the children? That's always a pinch.
Children, they sort of were different, you see. They would come up and want to catch your hand and try to talk to you, but then again, we had to ignore them, and that wasn't easy. Adults, yeah, but it wasn't easy with children.
Now, where did you go to? Because you were in the Hanover area. Where did you go?
We went to Dassel, D-A-S-S-E-L.
That's 43 miles south?
That's it.
Now, what was Dassel? Explain what it was.
Well, it's a town, and we became the occupiers of that town. Wally Wicks, the sergeant, he became the town clerk, in effect. And I became the person responsible for all arresting.
And
arresting. I did all the arrests. I was the aggressive one. I'd go out and collar them. And
so what would you tell me about that? Well, what were you? Were you provost or what? Policeman or what?
Well, there was a lot of talk about people being hiding from being in the SS. That there were SS soldiers and that trying to get into civilian clothes and hide the fact they were part of the SS, German troops. And we were being picking these up from time to time. People were denouncing them to us. People were saying, you know, that's an SS man over there. And also we get some official information come through. One, for instance, was the mayor, the current mayor of Dassau. I was told to go and arrest him and take him to a police station. So I learned that he worked in the gasworks. I went to the gasworks, and he wasn't there. He'd gone to the bank. And we had two civilian police with us, so I sent those police to find him and bring him back to us. And when he came back to us, I took him into custody. And instead of taking him straight to the police station, I had a bit of sympathy for him. I took him to his home, which was a flat, so he could pick up some washing kit and so on, in case he was kept in for a little while. And of course, his family were there, including the daughter, his wife and the daughter. They were crying their eyes out that I was taking them away. And after a little while, the daughter started swearing at me, in German, of course. She didn't know I was a temporary German interpreter, and I knew exactly what she was saying to me. I could have arrested her, of course, for abusing British soldiers, but I just pretended I couldn't understand her. And then I took her father off and delivered him to the police station.
Any other cases you remember?
Yeah, there were three or four men we had to arrest, people who denounced them. We went and picked them up and took them to the same police station. I remember lining them up there in the office. And one of them started to move around. So I sort of yelled at him to stand to attention, which he did for the whole time he was there, and then he was afraid to move until I let him go into the governor of the prison to be interviewed.
But there's another story where you seem to have to... there's trouble with Russian forced labour. they pose a threat to German farmers and things like that.
Well,
people on the outskirts of town. Anyway, tell me about that.
Well, here, the... I think the first thing is the occupied wooden buildings, of course, which have been put up for them.
The Russians did.
The Russian forced labor workers, Russian and Polish, most of them, Polish I think most. And they were moved out. We were taking them back to a center where they would be, organized and slowly to return home. But they wanted to burn down everything they'd been, but we wanted to use them. So we got them moved out. But I remember one man, he was determined to defy us. He was going to burn these buildings down. So two of us grabbed our rifles, fixed our bayonets, and chased after him. And chased him out. He went when he saw us coming with bayonets.
Now that looks like it might have been Sarsted rather than Dassau. But
it could well be, yeah.
You also sent patrols to protect people.
Yes, that was Sarsted, wasn't it?
Well, no, that's Dassel in your notes.
No, I think that's the wrong way round. You know, it might have been, I don't know.
Okay.
Again, the letters might tell. But what it was, anyway, we'd taken over an estate of houses, and we occupied them completely. The people just had to move out and leave everything, and we moved in. And a sergeant came up to me one day and said there was two ladies at the gate, that they were in a state about something. Could I come down and interpret it, see what it was? When I went down, these two old ladies said that they lived near the edge of some woods up there. And pardon me. And that some of these forced labour people that were living in the woods there had come and threatened them. They had disabled husbands, both of them, and they were frightened to go back. So I promised them that I'd get a patrol up two or three times at least during the night to make sure they were all right. And They went back then, and nothing more happened. They were all right after that.
Now, what were your billets like in Dassel?
Posh hotel. I had a marvellous room. I had the lot, a modern bedside lamp, table with plush tablecloth, lovely, everything, the bookcase. I was the only one that had a room to myself. Everybody else had two to a room. So I was living in luxury there. My own wash basin. Yeah.
Now, anything else about Dassel?
Well, only these guards. We
tell me about the guards.
Well, we had to mount guards on it, or the buildings which we occupied. And we made an event of the guard parade. Everything was spit and span, absolutely polished, and we'd go down and mount guard in the square, in the main square, and do it all in a very military fashion, and all to give an impression of the smart British soldiers, you know. They'd march off as if we were on parade ground for the Queen, as it were, you know.
Now, was there any question of you being posted to Japan? Because the war was over then. You know, I mean, were you aware of any question of it?
Yes, we were frightened of it, if you like. We knew there was a shortage of men and officers over there, and we'd been threatened by being forced to be officers before. And we had a fear, a couple of us, that they were going to take advantage of this and draft us away. They go out to the east.
As officers? Or?
Well, that's where he wanted us to be in this cut to start with, so that was a possibility. And it seemed to be officers they were short of. Being a technical regiment, they knew the people there were, you know, were reasonably able, capable of leading, I suppose.
Now, but on the 17th or 18th of June, you moved to Sarstedt. We'll put these two together, as you don't know which is which. And immediately, you seem to have a really dodgy task with a ammunition train. Do you want to tell that story?
There had been an ammunition train just in the centre or just edge of Sarstedt, which had been bombed and set alight. There had been a huge explosion there. There were trucks 50, 100 yards away from the track, blown there by the explosion. Buildings around, of course, all devastated. And
so this has happened before you got there?
Yeah, yeah. That's why we were sent there in a great panic, really, to go and keep everybody away from this situation. We had to set up patrols to make sure that nobody got anywhere near it.